welcome to Future Focused, Sophisticated Estate Planning with Wiggin and Dana, the show where CPAs, insurance professionals, investment brokers, trust companies, CFPs, and more can firm up on their understanding of estate planning strategies so they can better guide their clients to make wise decisions with their legacy. Future Focus is hosted by Aaron Nichols and Michael Clear, partners of the Private Client Services Department at Wiggin and Dana. Subscribe to Future Focused, Sophisticated Estate Planning on your favorite podcast platform and share episodes with your clients. And now, here are your hosts, Aaron and Michael.
Well, I'm here today right now with Larry Lipoff. Larry, tell me a little bit about yourself and then we'll jump in.
Sure. So I'm with Cohn Resnick. We're a CPA firm. We were about 1,700 people when I joined, and now we're about 4,200 people. I do domestic and international trust and estate work, planning, administration, compliance, oversee that. I try to be about 50-50 between domestic and international work, but the truth is 70 to 75% of what I do has some type of international element to it.
Awesome. I connected with you and talked to you, and we said, if we could just sit down and have a conversation of some interesting things that you've heard about while you've been at Heckerling, or as we've already talked about, whether they happened in a seminar or just some good conversations. So why don't we just start there? You had already told me about an interesting one.
Great. So a Gideon Rothschild came to me and knew he was retired, and he's telling me he is and he isn't. But he asked me, have you heard of something called a Rockefeller waterfall? No. And he told me that he didn't either, but someone asked him. So he went on the internet and did his research.
ChatGPT.
Yes. Or whatever. Said it's when you buy life insurance policies on three or four generations. As a generation passes away, it helps fund the life insurance in the next generation. I imagine, as you need it, you bleed out the cash surrender value with some type of non-taxable loans. We know that with life insurance, you could often borrow up to 90% of the cash surrender value, and you could put it into a trust that could be like New York Bill would be only about 90 years, but you could go into states like Connecticut, Florida, and have 800, 1,000 years. Some states have repealed their rule against perpetuities, and it'd be forever. And it's all asset protected, and you could have a corporate trustee, maybe someone in the family's involved, a friend's involved, make distribution advisors, you have investment advisors, all sounds really great.
So you're starting with a GST exempt trust, life insurance on that top generation, and then just moving it down over time.
Exactly.
It's a phenomenal wealth creation strategy.
I would think so.
That's pretty good.
Another thing is you wonder, in this type of environment, current events and some of the sessions, and you would think, hey, what are we going to really do? Because maybe there's more definition to the Corporate Transparency Act, but how much new has come about? One thing that I haven't heard, but I really think we have to have more consideration, discussion about, is dealing with interest rates that have gone up. A lot of our younger practitioners have never dealt with that. Maybe we started and interest rates were 8% or so and 75-20 rates and you had charitable remainder trusts, but all they know about is installment sales to grantor trusts, CLATs.
Refinancing notes.
Exactly.
Bringing the interest rate down. Yes. Now we have notes that are coming due, which were at 0.9%, 1.1%, and now they're coming back at a...
They went up to 5.8, now 5.2. And now I saw in an email today that Bernstein is predicting 4.8% for February. So it's bouncing around. And you really have to think through what's going to be in terms of planning. Does anything change? Maybe it doesn't. Maybe grads, you just keep on doing it or not. You know, certain industries will be impacted more than others. Do you consider in drafting pecuniaries, reverse pecuniaries? Do you see more fractionals? But let's say you say fractionals make more sense, but it could really be that a lot of practitioners, especially young practitioners, they never dealt with a fractional.
I've never seen it. They've never done it fractional or maybe a pecuniary just because of the way in which they practice. I've also seen it with some of our family-owned businesses that are multi-generational that have been moved from generation to generation. where the senior generation, maybe not as involved in the business anymore, has been like, you know, I was around the last time there were high interest rates. So although I don't need to be terribly involved in the business, I do have some insights to be able to offer you and be able to offer the family. So that piece is very interesting.
Here's something separate from the conference. One of my sons, he and a partner, they're basically brokers for mortgages for multifamily complexes, maybe 50, 100, 200 people in residential apartments. And the way a lot of the structures and planning was with low rates, and they never locked in the lower rates. Kept on telling them, lock in, it's not going to go lower. And then they wound up with variable rates, and they're getting bombed. And you're going to probably see a lot of residential, you know, continuing. We're seeing the beginning of it. Some real big residential real estate empires are going to come down. And we see, just because of COVID, hardly people come into the office, or maybe they're being forced in by some. But commercial real estate, you're going to see a real changeover that those of us that are old enough have seen the ups and downs of real estate. But a lot of people never saw the downs of real estate.
Haven't seen the full cycle yet.
Exactly. That cycle is very important. And where do you get in? And what type of planning do you do? And those that sold a business, they had a liquidation event, and now they have cash. At what point are they going to say real estate has gone down low enough that it makes sense to go in and hopefully do it with some type of long-term trust? So you're just passing it down again, looking at asset protection outside the transfer tax system. Could be a really great play at the right time. And we as advisors have to have our eyes and ears open to catch that, to work with our clients for that.
Right. Developing a lot more quivers, arrows in the quiver, I guess would be the right way of saying that.
Understood. Yes.
So is there something that has stand out to you so far from one of the sessions that you've pulled from? I see your notes.
So there's quite a bit of discussion about the Paulson case, about trustee liabilities. And also, is it going to make potential trustees much more reticent to take on new assignments because they don't know what they're going to wind up being responsible for? And personally, what I didn't hear them really spending enough time with, and I think we'll happen to have more, that it was a tax court memo decision. Now, memo decisions are not the full tax court, and they don't have the precedent standing. So maybe the reaction, and it's important, but it may not provide us the clarity that we really need as practitioners to be speaking to our clients who are trustees or thinking about being trustees.
Right. It's another one of those. It's a piece that informs what we're doing, and it scares us. It gives us an opportunity to highlight some of the risks that are associated with it.
Interestingly, the Safford decision, which speaks to gift tax disclosure, and even if it's the wrong year, it still works, seemingly. Court is saying, hey, that's good. And as practitioners, but how could that actually be?
I have trouble comprehending that sort of a thing. I don't remember if it's the exact one, but when they've elected gift splitting on something that couldn't be gift splitted, or they've done an incorrect allocation of generation skipping tax that couldn't have been done, but it was filed, and now they come and they say, well, that's right. Because it leaves us as practitioners in a tough spot, because we've seen matters in cases where automatic allocation, let's say, didn't apply, that they thought it would apply. And maybe they filled it out incorrectly on a 709, and just you don't know where does that leave us.
Sure. So what's even more troubling is that this is a tax court memo decision. And we know that tax court memo decisions are not precedent setting. So everyone's getting excited and they're reacting to it, and they may not have the precedent that they need. And when they're speaking to their clients, we just saw in our internal reviews what we did. Oh, we're fine because of this decision. Well, maybe not.
Right. It makes it tricky to rely upon it. But it does inform us of what's out there, what they have seen. Similar today in the session on grats, when the speaker was talking about how, in fact, you could have two different values of the same 1% interest in a company on the same day. And sure, her story came from an audit that she had. And ultimately, they had two different values for the same asset because a piece of it went to charity and a piece of it was in the grat. And it makes no sense, but it did in fact happen.
But you can't rely upon it.
Cannot rely upon it. No, not at all.
You know, she brought up an interesting point about gift splitting. Gift splitting often gets me concerned. And here, speaking about gift splitting, does it create an ETIP issue?
Gift splitting when you have an ETIP. So in a grat.
Can you even gift split?
So can you ETIP a grat? We've seen people advertently or inadvertently gift split Q-perts, which we know is a bad idea. So ingrained in my head is that gift splitting an ETIPable thing is a bad idea, and mostly because of Q-perts and the risk of death and not being able to get the exemption back. On a grat, maybe not, because you use so little exemption in order to make it happen. But nonetheless, like, it, did you opt out of GST correctly? Did one of, so only the grantor of the trust opted out of GST, but the other person didn't? Yeah.
One thing that she mentioned about electing out when you file the initial return is something that I do. She mentioned that she's been doing it. I don't know if all practitioners do it. I've seen, and then they go 2 years and then they forget.
Correct. Either way.
I'd like to
either
do it
to
2 years
then,
and then put in a
or
note.
Or to allocate. Yeah.
Yes. Put it in. And question that we had last year, but haven't heard any follow-up. People are talking about returning to the grail of purchasing the remainder interest of a grat with a dynastic trust or the economic interest. So we wound up, and if it goes back to late 1990s, so that was one of the real big things. And then the IRS said, we don't know if it's a taxable distribution and taxable termination, but we're going to challenge it anyway. And everyone seemed to stop doing it. But in today's environment, economic environment, maybe you wait 6 months and maybe the economics are worth it to do it, because in theory, it's not a taxable distribution. It's not a taxable termination. You have to really let your client know that you can't provide, just like a community property trust. Statute works, but it's not tested. Do you at least discuss it with the client? Let's say you have a private equity. One spouse is a private equity person, the one's not. You have these carried interests that have gone up in value. Would it be nicer if you had it in a community property trust?
Yes, it would. It would be nicer. It would be great if we knew it worked.
Exactly. But do you at least have a responsibility? I know people say maybe it's not appropriate to bring it up because you don't have finalization. My question on the other side is it appropriate? And could a planner be held responsible if they don't bring it up and say, here's something statutorily, it's there in a number of states. It hasn't been adequately tested. And if theory works, and the law says it should say it is, don't we have it a responsibility at least to bring it up with extreme caution?
Yeah, and has to think of it and talk about it as a possible strategy. Also, during the grad session, she talked a little bit about using promissory notes to lock in the success of a transaction.
Not everyone likes it.
And what the arguments are, if you then pay off the promissory note in order to have the liquidity to pay the annuity payment. And she just left it there and moved on, which was great because there's no answer. There's risk involved, but at the end of the day, you treated it as a transaction. You did it and it's risky. But is it more risky than had you just put in cash and controlled the, you're just protecting the positive?
So certain financial institutions will extend notes, loans, knowing that you're going to use it to lock in your grat success or failure, and then they'll wind up getting paid out, and it could be a good credit risk, and they could make some money and help you accomplish your needs. One thing that was from Paul Lee's presentation, with all the partnerships, and took it down maybe a drop of a level compared to the past, but part of it was, if you have an installment sale to a grantor trust, of taking that holding of the note and the grantor trust and putting them into a partnership, and that would be everything's with grantor trust, so it collapses in terms of it's not a partnership, it's a disregarded entity, and therefore, legally, well, tax-wise, there's no cancellation indebtedness if the person dies. Because for tax purposes, all together, it's not separate. And then ways of structuring in terms of basis shifts to move out so that you wind up taking it. And once a person's dead, obviously you don't have a grantor trust. And now it's separate and you don't have to go through that analysis and possibly, and most likely, especially with the guidance we received during the year, to lock it in that you're going to have gains. So sounds like a good approach, at least to consider.
Yeah. I think the other thing, shout out to all of our divorce lawyers that listen. And he talked a little bit about grantor trusts and SLATs, spousal lifetime access trusts, and how when you create a SLAT during a marriage, it is always a grantor trust. And the divorce, even though it's no longer a spouse, the trust remains a grantor trust. And it's something I think a lot of divorce lawyers wouldn't know, wouldn't think about, may or may just assume that it's no longer a grantor trust because it's no longer a spouse as a beneficiary or there's something that's triggered it. And I think that's one of those areas that accountants and lawyers can provide a lot of value during a divorce engagement and showing why we need that team approach during those engagements so we can solve that problem. He offered one solution on solving it, but even just having those conversations, we can help get to the best family resolution on that sort of a thing.
So for the audience, you take the delta between the SLAT that has more value and you decant, so then you pretty much even out. Then the two even out, you tell the former spouses, you can't stand each other, but you be partners. And then we wait. And hopefully there's years to the trust that you set up. And then you be mindful of the anti-mixing bowls. So you wait 7 years and then you push out value. Now, the theory is great. But the reality is, could you imagine?
Yeah.
You can't stand each other. This one had an affair. This one stole money and this and that. Oh, but you're going to be a partner for at least 7 years. And if not, we're going to have a problem.
I think in the least, it was helpful so that people understand that it continues as a grantor trust after the divorce. And there continues to be tax liabilities back to the grantor. And remembering that piece, at least as you're crafting a divorce agreement or trying to come up with a property settlement, whether or not you get to the actual solution that he provided through a number of great slides, just having that information in there can be very helpful.
Agreed.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to hit on that seems like a good takeaway?
I think we're good.
Okay. Well, great. That was a lot of fun. Thank you for joining me today.
That was fantastic. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Future Focused, Sophisticated Estate Planning, hosted by Aaron Nichols and Michael Clear, partners of the Private Client Services Department at Wigan and Dana. At Wigan and Dana, our aim is preserving the wealth that a family has worked so hard to create and pride ourselves in offering value-driven solutions and results. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform, share episodes with your clients, and follow our highly talented, creative, and experienced lawyers on LinkedIn for even more great insight. We'll see you next time on Future Focused, Sophisticated Estate Planning.